From the pages of the Blizzard, the Football Quarterly, we bring you the Blizzard Podcast, a weekly look back through the Blizzard archives, where we bring you some of our favourite articles to have appeared in the magazine since we began back in 2011. In episode 39, rather than an article, we bring you the audio from our Q&A event at the WS Society in Edinburgh on the 19th of May. As with all our live events, we do the best we can with the available sound quality. Unfortunately, recording in large cavernous rooms means that you don't get studio quality sound, but hopefully that doesn't detract from your enjoyment of the evening. This is part two of the evening's discussion, so if for some reason you haven't yet listened to part one, head back to iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever you get your audio from and put that right. Now, back to our host for the evening, Daniel Gray.
Hello, thanks for coming back. I realised that I forgot to introduce myself earlier and I'm not Richard Gordon. By any stretch of the imagination. I'm Daniel Gray, author of well-regarded, low-selling football books. I'm going to start with a question about the Euros, because they're coming up, as I don't need to remind anyone in this room. Jonathan, firstly, do international tournaments matter anymore now the club game is at the top, is so rich, so big, so in your face, the Champions League, the Premier League, Bundesliga?
I think they do. There seems to be no question that club football, the level, the quality of football played, is way, way better than international football. And that's probably been the case since the mid-80s, maybe even earlier, that once football became systematised, once you had to play as a team rather than as individuals, then obviously the greater time you have working together at club level means that those systems are going to be that much more sophisticated at club level. But I still think that in a sense the flaws of international football are its beauty, that if you have a generation in your country where you just don't have a good left back, you can't go out and spend 30 million quid and buy one. You have to work out a way of getting around it. If the footballing gods have played one of those horrible jokes on you, and as say Cameroon found in the late 80s, when two of the best goalkeepers in the world were Cameroonian, with Joseph Antoine Bell and Thomas Nkono, who are arguably the two greatest African goalkeepers of all time, and they both turn up in Cameroon at exactly the same time, and obviously you can only play one of them, and understandably they come to hate each other. And that's one of the great stories, one of the great narratives of football.
I thought you were going to go to Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard here for a second.
Well, that's a very insipid version of the same tale. but I also think it has an importance, because there still is something nice about not playing for money. And maybe in Europe we see that less. But certainly if you go to the Cup of Nations or the Cup of America, the level of interest in those games, the emotions those games stir, is profound. And I'm not going to go through the whole Zambia story again, because I tell it every time I'm on a stage. I mean, you were talking about the Fulham-Juve game, when the whole press box wanted Fulham to win. The entire press box, apart from the Ivorians that night, wanted Zambia to win. I think the entire stadium wanted Zambia to win. And I've never known anything as emotional as that. And I don't think you could be quite that emotional about a club side. I think international football still has a place, but it has to fight harder and harder for its place. And I'm not sure doing something like extending the tournament, as they have with the Euros, and making it a slog in the way the World Cup is a slog, is necessarily the right way to do it.
Do these tournaments matter in France still?
An awful lot, perhaps for different reasons. I mean, they matter because we want to show that we're capable of putting a good show together. It's a great opportunity, for Didier Deschamps to rekindle, the love affair between the French public and the national team. And it's a completely changed national team. There's no Mathieu Valbuena, there's no Karim Benzema.
Yeah.
We've got a very young, untainted team, which hopefully will make us forget about what happened beforehand, which is basically between 2002 and literally now. I mean, since, France going to the World Cup in 2002, you remember how everybody was saying they've got the best goal scorer in Italy, David Trezeguet, the best goal scorer in France, Djibril Cissé, the best goal scorer in England, Thierry Henry, was also Golden Boot that year. and we scored zero goal and were kicked out by Senegal, Denmark, and whatever. And Uruguay, with Thierry Henry getting a red card. And since then, there's been this this love story has gone sour, particularly in South Africa, with Dominic and all these things, the strike. I mean, okay, they're French, they strike, it's quite normal, but... but we ran the buses on time, usually.
So the reason I was late today in Sunday was because of a French air traffic control
strike. I knew this was coming. So, as far as we're concerned, this is the most important tournament in the history of the galaxy. Something like that.
And are we ascribing too much importance and power to football, or can it help in France at the moment with things in society, if you want to
Woof.
Be?
I think we should discuss this after. And it's definitely not on the record. It might. Yes, what are the odds?
I was just asking.
3-1, something like that. I think it's ridiculous.
So Kevin and Alan, Scotland aren't there. People might be aware that Scotland aren't there, and the Englishman should probably shut up. Alan, can Scotland qualify for a tournament again? The question on everyone's lips, all pundits' lips.
Yeah, I'm sure they can. I'm sure they can. I feel I've got a part to play. I think I'm cursed because I started working at Scotsman in '98 and thinking this is my dream job. I can't wait to be travelling to see Scotland in major tournaments for every 2 years, every 2 years going on from there. And here I am, having not covered Scotland at a major tournament yet. But I do have hope. I do have hope. It was one interesting stat, I think, that I think Scotland had the oldest team average age in the qualifiers, which I think probably has to be addressed. I think Gordon Strachan already is addressing that. We've got some good, I think, decent upcoming younger players coming through. Kevin was talking about earlier, Tierney at fullback. And the squad that Gordon's announced for the next two games, friendlies, Italy against Italy and France, does seem a bit younger in nature. So, I mean, it's interesting to see what Jonathan was talking about, goalkeepers, and how Cameroon had two of the finest goalkeepers in Africa at one stage. We seem to have three of the finest Scottish goalkeepers all at the same time, unfortunately. We need to have somebody, you know, a decent striker or you know, a world-class midfielder. I think that would make a lot of difference. You know, look at someone like Scott Brown, whose best days are possibly behind him. You know, we just really need that talismanic figure, I think, just to lead us into a tournament. And I just can't see it right now. You know, someone like Lee Griffiths has scored 40 goals in domestic league, but whether he can do it in an international sense, I do wonder. But no, I do live in hope. It was quite sore. I think I looked up Wikipedia, looking at the... they've got a great thing. They've got a map of the qualifiers for Euro 2016 for the finals, and it's coloured in map, and this is a splurge of blue indicating the countries that have qualified, and then just and yellow is just these little tiny little dots of yellow that countries that haven't qualified, and there's Scotland at the top of the British Isles, and then Iceland, of course, is blue, and that really hit home that we're not going, are we?
I mean, I know somebody who just wants to speak up for your own country, and you can overdo it. But I do think Scotland played very well in that game against Poland. And yes, they were knocked out in the last few seconds of the game. That doesn't mean Scotland are therefore hopeless and should be scattered to the winds. I thought that was a pretty good effort, a horrible conclusion. But I don't think Scotland are demoralised or having to destroy everything they've done so far and starting again. They have good players in the team, and they did quite well throughout that attempt to reach the finals. I've seen worse than that in football over the years. I think maybe what's missing now is people don't seem to respond to any particular figure. I mean, for example, Joe Jordan was somebody that fans, the whole crowd, you know. Seem to love him because he was so such a leader and he'd ready to prepare, put his body in and take all the heart that comes as a centre forward who also is a good player. And I think Scotland needs something like that. In the attack, I don't really see a genuinely good centre forward for international football, but you never know, these things just come. One day a player suddenly, if he gets more confidence and he gives a chance and the club lets him progress, and maybe somebody else comes in. Because I don't think Gordon Strachan can just simply keep the same players. he can't find better ones, but maybe he can find ones that are more potential that are still to be tapped. And I think that would be the way to go.
Just sticking on the theme of Scotland, Jonathan, we were talking earlier, I mean, you know, you grew up not too far from the border, and yet the Scottish game was quite remote to you, and it's a similar experience. To me, it was exotic almost, sort of, where is St Mirren, that kind of thing.
And I don't want to go, it's unpaid
for, I've been twice, even though I couldn't possibly comment. And yet, down the years, Scots played for all our best teams. There'll have been memories of Scottish players and managers at Sunderland and things like that. Number one, just to bring some of those out for us, but also to talk about, can that happen again? Has the influence of Scottish players rather than managers on the game gone forever?
Well, I mean, it's one of the things, I think it's always worth remembering when people complain about how few England qualified players are in the Premier League, which, although strange, hardly anybody's talked about it this year, but I think it's the lowest number ever. I think it's down to 30% now of the players in the Premier League are England qualified.
29.9 of starters.
We'll call it 30. But you look back at the 1890s, you know, the English League starts in 1888. You look at the 1890s, and the two dominant teams were Sunderland and Aston Villa, both of whom had teams packed with Scots. You know, the great. There's only four managers in English League history, have won the league with more than one side. There's most recently Kenny Dalglish, Brian Clough, Herbert Chapman. And the first one, who's the only one to have won it twice with more than one side, is Tom Watson, who won it three times for Sunderland, twice for Liverpool. And his big idea wasn't a tactical thing. His big idea was, let's go shopping in Scotland. Yeah. And so the Sunderland team that won the league in 1892, seven of the regular starting 11 were Scottish. So that influence is profound. And it was, you know, back in the 1890s, the place you looked for, if you're English, the place you looked for exoticism, the place where you plucked your great talents off the shelf was Scotland. No, we're clearly never going to go back to that. I mean, there's just not, to start with, there's not enough people in Scotland that if you have a population of, 5-6 million, that's, you know, the Cooper and Szymanski book looks at what makes a successful national team. So it's down to sort of football history, how long you've cared about football. It's down to GDP and it's down to population. Countries with a population of 5 or 6 million are never going to be able to have a sustained run at the top of the game.
Except Uruguay.
Uruguay are the massive exception. I guess the Dutch and Croatia maybe you point to as being exceptions. But even Uruguay, I mean, although they're the most successful team in the Copa America, and although they regularly qualify for World Cups, they've had their... You know, the 90s were very bad for Uruguay. They didn't do anything in the 90s. And that was when they had Francescoli. So I think... It was always going to be declined in those days of the 1890s, but I think what's more worrying is that we've declined from the days of sort of the 70s and 80s, that when I sort of grew up watching football, and you looked at that Liverpool side with Hansen and Souness and Dalglish, and it was almost inconceivable that top English sides wouldn't have a Scottish core. And now, Scottish players sort of stand out.
I remember interviewing Bobby Charlton. He was mentioning to me that when he was growing up, County Durham, is that right? Where did Bobby Charlton?
He grew up in Ashington, in Northumberland.
Yeah, Northumberland, wasn't it? Yeah. And he said he used to look to the Scottish Cup final rather than the English Cup final, because they, for some, the North of England seemed to look towards the Scottish Cup final. And he said he watched some, on TV, watched some great Scottish Cup finals. But I mean, is that something that you had experience of? And would you, this Cup final weekend?
I don't remember ever being on live for Scottish Cup final, but certainly, at half time, you get the highlights from the Scottish Cup final. And it's, you were aware of this as being a thing of equal importance. It just happened to be happening. I mean, if you grew up in Sunderland, Glasgow is closer to you than London is. So I think, if you grew up in Sunderland, I think of the 13 teachers in my primary school, 4 were Scottish. There was a huge Scottish influence because people came down to work in the shipyards. There was a tradition, I mean, it sounds bizarre now, a tradition of people coming from Glasgow to the northeast to go on holiday. It was a regular holiday destination. The influence was very, very strong. And certainly, I mean, this is something I hadn't even really thought of until the referendum and everything last year. But I always felt profoundly British when I grew up, because so many people I knew, so many of my teachers in my school were Scottish.
Well, you could add, just Preston, North End, the Invincibles. I think their manager got 8 players to come from Queen's Park, just employ them, and they were the first team to go through a whole season unbeaten in England. It was, 1888?
Kevin, do you think Scotland's not producing as many players? It's just a proportional thing. The English Premiership, as we're saying, is 29.9, etc. Is it, or is it that thing? There's no one's playing on the cobbles anymore. No one's out. That classic argument of the tanner ball players and all of that.
No, I think the tanner ball thing's gone. But on the other hand, they've got far more scientific ways of coaching players and understanding the person and the style. In depth, and so I don't think at all feel at all miserable about it. I don't think Scotland's maybe. I mean, you're not going to have players, kids running around in the field, outside in the streets rather, and being in danger of being knocked over by cars. So now, by dint of the culture we have, you know, we have to take people into areas where they are. Training grounds and so on, where they can be given a sensible way to develop the talent, or the talent that is innate within them at the moment. But I'm not that depressed about it. The Celtic have uncovered a terrific player, Kieran Tierney, at left back. And if they did that once every few years, it would help the club. The only problem is, look, like, already people in like Tierney are being spotted on by the English. Scouts, and I don't think Celtic is he'd be crazy to leave the club, and he's so young, teenager. But maybe at the time, maybe not be long before a club in England wants to buy him.
So maybe the question there should have been: can Scotland qualify while we still have gravel pitches outside Scotland? And we want to go to audience questions now. I've certainly got one at the back that reserved his place at half time. We've got ahead.
How you doing, lads? It's more to the Scottish-based guys, and hopefully the other guys can give an opinion. Scottish football is struggling, as you've rightly said there. I think, personally, in terms of income, alcohol is a big thing. In Scotland, we are restricted to have a pint. You've invited 130 to 180 people in. You've invited us all to have a wee drink before, a wee drink at half time, and nobody's wrecked the joint, which I'm thinking is damn good. So I'd like to ask you guys, for those who don't know, we've been banned from alcohol since 1980, since the cup final. And I'm just wondering, do you think it's time? I mean, it would be a monetary thing to the clubs. As a fan who goes to Germany quite a lot, I've seen the influence of alcohol on individual clubs. I just think it's about time we have a wee sensible approach on alcohol.
Can I just say that there is plenty of alcohol at the ground. However, they're behind curtains at half time in the executive boxes. Believe me, there's plenty of drinking going on. The only person that can't get it, of course, is a natural fan with a season ticket who's got no chance of getting into the lounges unless he pays a lot of money. So I think there's a lot of hypocrisy in that side of the football.
Yeah, certainly it is the mark of a mature environment, isn't it? Allowing people to drink and we can all have a good time, have a few pints. But, I mean, I don't know. I was talking about Scottish football ills earlier, and in fact, we had this conversation downstairs at half time about alcohol, and I was asking the guys from England what exactly is the situation in England. But obviously, you can have a pint at half time on the concourse, but not in the stands themselves. I mean, I don't know. I speaking very personally, I just don't go to football match and think, God, I really wish I was having a pint right now at half time. I really wish I could go for a pint. I just don't. I maybe that's just because I've grown up and it's not been there. It's not been available to me. So I mean, it's not something that I think is the most foremost in my mind to bring into Scottish football. But it does seem to work in England. It seems to work well. And you know, whether you want a pint of sort of lukewarm lager at half time, and I know that the quality is probably not great either. But it would be a good thing. I'd be in favour of it. But I just don't. You know, I don't find myself thinking, you know, it's foremost in my list of. Things to improve Scottish football.
Jonathan, has it? I mean, what's the ale like at Sunderland at half time? It's never the greatest.
I honestly don't think I've ever had a drink at half time. I just haven't. I mean, there's certain press rooms. Actually, there's only one press room where you can drink now. After an incident at Chelsea, and they took that away.
It's a very funny incident.
It was an incident we sadly can't talk about.
Definitely go off the record if this is being talked about.
So but I mean, I sort of think the law in England, which is you can drink but not inside of the pitch, so you can drink on the concourse or in the executive boxes with the curtains closed, I think actually works quite well because it forces people to have a break. And I think if you're going to football and you feel you need a drink while watching it, then that suggests the football is probably not great. And if you really can't, I mean, I get that it might be nice to have a drink at half time, but if you really can't wait 45 minutes for a drink, then maybe you should be asking yourself some questions.
The one thing I would say, Jonathan, is that it's really a question of it's one rule for a certain kind of people and one rule for others. And that, I think, is morally totally unacceptable. The fact is, for my sins, I've been to some rugby union over the past few years. I actually hate that game now. I used to love it, but it's now huge, big shit houses running towards each other. But anyway, the great thing about the rugby, it's a bit of a surreal image. The great thing about the rugby and the cricket, where you have to say, Jonathan, and we've been to the cricket together, drinking is an essential part of the game. It's the fact that rugby fans, who are no angels, actually behave pretty appallingly around at Twickenham, are allowed to have their pints of Guinness and whatnot at Twickenham during the game. No problem. Nobody bats an eyelid. A bit in the same way that when you go and see a rock gig, you can bring your drink in. You go to a classical concert. No, sorry, sir, you can't do that. And that is disgraceful. Why should football fans be treated any differently from rugby union fans or cricket fans? And I don't get that. So either it's the same rule for everybody, or football should be, it should be prohibited in every single sport. It's not the case.
Sorry. The lady who booked this question was actually a bit forward of the gentleman who asked the question.
Oh, yeah, so we'll have that one now. The one we were going to have. That was about Leicester City. Right, there you go. I must say that I had, when Gordon Strachan was manager of Middlesbrough, he needed about 3 small bottles of wine and 2 pints at half time, so I'm all for it.
Okay, well, my question is again about the Euros. Obviously, Leicester won the league this year. You'd like to think that's encouraged a lot of the smaller teams at the Euros, the 2 Irish teams, Iceland, Albania, to play a little more attacking, a bit more freedom, because I know a lot of fans, I know especially, are worried that the games are going to be shit because all the teams will want to do is avoid defeat rather than actually attack. So do you think that will have any bearing? And also, secondarily, do you think anybody can beat France?
Well, you can start with the secondary question.
France can beat France. There's absolutely no problem.
Jonathan, will it be an overly defensive tournament?
Well, I think one of the problems international football has is what I was talking about before, that at club level, coaches have so much more time to work with players that if you're working with a team, understandably, the first thing you do is try and get the defence right, because there's an instinctive sort of self-preservation there. If you lose a game 6-0 in a World Cup, it will be remembered forever. That will be a stain that will shame your nation and will shame your name as a manager forever. That will not be forgotten. If you lose 3 games 1-0, so what? So managers understandably try and get the defence right first. And maybe actually that's just the way you should build a team. You should start with having a solid base. How do we get the ball? But what it means is with less time to work on attacking formulations. And I think it's something that people often, I think, don't appreciate or forget, that a lot of the way the Premier League teams or Champions League teams attack is, it's not quite pre-programmed, but they have almost set moves that they adapt. And I think at international level, you just don't have time to get the level of sophistication that you have at club level, whereas you do have time to get the defence right. So I think that's why you tend to see fewer goals in international level. I think one of the other problems is that in this tournament, finishing third in the group for those 3 teams, for those 6 teams, who finish third will go through. And so, if you get a draw and a win, you're safe. And that, I think, will lead to caution in the early games. And I think that is a concern. Will the example of Leicester inspire people? I mean, I think if teams are inspired to play in a slightly more attacking way, it's probably the example of qualifying rather than Leicester. That your qualifying was actually way, way more interesting than I thought it would be. I suspect more interesting than it will be in the future. And some of the nations for whom this is a rare appearance at a major tournament, so Northern Ireland or Iceland, maybe they will be inspired to sort of have a go and make it more memorable. Because Iceland actually played pretty attacking football in the qualifiers. But then set against, you've got people like Romania who conceded 2 goals in the 10 games in qualifying. And that's not because they're a great side who stopped the opposition from playing. It's because they're really defensive and really boring, and they're a terrible side. This is the worst remaining side in living memory, and somehow they've qualified. It's awful.
Okay, I'll take another audience question now. Someone down at the front here. I saw your hand go up first there. Lad with the red top on. Just, you never hear Dimble, but say lad with the red top on. Say loss.
Hiya, lads. Okay. After Liverpool scored a record number of goals in 2014, then they lost Luis Suarez to transfer, and Daniel Sturridge was on long-term injury. So that's over 50 goals. Brendan Rodgers still guided them to 2 semi-finals. One of them, Eden Hazard, went down very easily in the box at Anfield, and they lost 1-0 on aggregate. They then, the next summer, lost Raheem Sterling and the club captain, Steven Gerrard. So that's 4 players from, I don't know, from the team that had almost won the league. Can you explain why Brendan Rodgers has since been treated as a leper in terms of out-of-work managers?
We've covered your city and Brendan Rodgers. Straight to Philippe, who wants to go off the record.
No. I couldn't possibly comment. No. I think it was entirely understandable. I mean, sometimes the fact a manager is sacked from a club has got nothing to do with the fact he's rubbish. It's just the fact that he's lost the dressing room or something has happened and you can feel the club is becoming stale. You know, and I could actually rebound what you were saying about Kike Flores. I've actually been with some Watford fans recently on several occasions. And they were all telling me it's funny because from the outside it looks like it's a crazy decision. But we, from the inside, who go to the games every single time, we felt that it was not quite working, not quite ticking. We don't hate him. We're not going to say it was terrible. It was wonderful for us. But somehow it's run its course. In the case of Brendan Rodgers, it's a bit more complicated because I genuinely think the guy has got a serious ego problem, and which is probably being treated for. I mean, maybe being fired is a bit of a form of therapy for him. And maybe he'll come back stronger and taller. And when you're offered a chance, listen, if you're Liverpool, you get Jurgen Klopp. And you say, bye-bye, Brandon. Hello, Jurgen. I mean, come on, it's not really much of a choice. That it's a decision. And he was treated perhaps not as well as you would have liked him to be, but it was fairly obvious from everybody at the ground, at the club, and also from without the club, that it had run its course and it was not just not right. It was not happening anymore. And this, again, doesn't necessarily reflect on the talent or the personality of the manager, even if in the case of Brendan Rodgers, it might.
Right, let's have some more audience questions as we... I'll take one from right at the back there.
So 2 questions for Philippe. Can you tell us about the Chelsea press room incident? And second of all...
That will be very short.
Okay. The second question was, are you upset that Hatem Ben Arfa has not gone to the Euros?
I'm very upset that Hatem Ben Arfa is not at the Euros, but on the other hand, I'm very upset that many people are not at the Euros, but you've got to think of the amount of choice that Didier Deschamps had. Kevin Gamero is not in the French 23, he's on the waiting list. So that tells you a bit about the attacking potential in that French team. So I'm very disappointing for Hatem Ben Arfa, who is a great guy, lovely footballer, and also has worked so hard at Nice. To go back into contention and manage to do it. He's been really one of the stars of this season in Ligue 1. So I'm very sad for him because I actually like him very much. On the other hand, you can completely understand the decision from Didier Deschamps. That was the first thing. The second thing was what? Oh, yes. A reporter whose name shall not be repeated.
It wasn't me. Don't
it wasn't.
Me.
But you were there, I think, on that occasion.
There.
You were there, okay. It was when Rafa was manager at Chelsea. And Chelsea at the time had a bar, a free bar, where they were serving three different kinds of wine. And actually, wine, which was not very good. I will always remember Carlo Ancelotti walking in a press conference, and you were there. And he said, somebody said, do you want a glass of wine? Okay, all right. And so he gave it to somebody. It was a chap from The Star, whose name Danny Falbrook, brought a glass of wine to Carlo, took a sip. It's shit. That was the beginning of the press conference, one of the many reasons why we loved Carlo. Anyway, this particular reporter, Rafa, is there, and who is actually quite a good customer, and the reporter asked the same question.
Well, the reporter, I think, had not gone out for the second half.
He'd
remained with a television pundit in the press room.
Whose name shall not be repeated.
And they had availed themselves fully of the facilities.
And he kept asking the same question. And Rafa was answering it. He kept answering putting the same question to it. It was just a bit embarrassing. It was not broadcast live, unfortunately. But Chelsea, in their wisdom, decided, instead of banning the reporter, of banning the alcohol. She's dressed absolutely disgraceful. And so since then, there's only been one club where it's possible to have a quiet drink after you find a story, or in the case of before. And I'm not, no, not Jonathan, never.
No, well, the, no, n- almost never, but Sunderland, after the Everton game last week, they laid out stripes of red and white wine in the press room.
Wow.
Which was a nice touch.
And if you go to Auxerre, this is which has got one of the crappiest buffets in the world, not to be compared with Chelsea's, which is a thing of magnificence, southern Apulian in its opulence. But what they have is they've got Chablis on tap, literally on tap. Auxerre.
Well, the biggest revelation for me there was that the Daily Star has reporters. I just had no idea. Let's have another audience question. First was a very quick hand there. It was like Alan Shearer, just to rebalance.
Two questions. Firstly, now we're in Edinburgh. How do the panel feel Saturday will go? Not the FA Cup final, obviously. Scottish Cup. Second one is for Jonathan. I was down for the Everton game. It was a brilliant night. You think Coney's the best player ever to grace the Premier League?
Alan, Saturday, Hibs.
Yeah.
Surely now.
Surely the world is not so cruel that that Hibs cannot win the Scottish Cup this weekend. I think I counted up. I think is it 12 now? 12 Scottish Cup finals in a row that they've lost. Which, that's pretty. That's something else. And then talking of curses, football curses earlier. That has to be one of the worst, I think. I'm. My heart broke a bit for Alan Stubbs when he came into the press room. I'm quite impressed that you're talking about press rooms in English football. We're lucky to get Dundee United, for example. We've the press room as a pantry that's turned into the press room just after the game for half an hour. Then they were ushered out amongst the kind of half-eaten pies, etc. So I'm in awe of this of English football. But my heart broke when Alan Stubbs came in after the Falkirk game, and after Tibbs had lost a last-minute goal to lose that in playoffs. So. I just think Hibs have been abused too much over the years, and I think that this is going to be their weekend. So my prediction is Hibs 2, Rangers 1, with a last minute winner for Hibs to redress all those last minute winners they've conceded recently.
I wish I could agree with you, but you seem to be in a downer, Hibs. Failing to qualify and get promotion. It's going to take a lot of effort to lift that Hibs group. Do you really think they'll be winning that game?
Yeah. Look back at the four games I've had in the league. Hibs have won two, Rangers have won two. It was that kind of that Petrofac Cup game at the start, wasn't there, at the start of the season, which the 6-2, I think it was, to Rangers. But I think you can write that off. But no, Hibs have got good enough players. Certainly, it's obviously it's a case of whether Stubbs has been able to
rouse them this week, try and get them over the disappointment of last Friday night. I think these players are going to be pretty well steeled to do it. I think a lot of them possibly might not be back next season, so I think this is their one kind of, they know it's their one chance to write themselves into history, and that it really will be history. You know, 1902 is a long, long time, and I know that because my team, Dundee, haven't won it since 1910, and yeah. I'm kind of hoping Hibs win it, so the spotlight falls on Dundee, and so Dundee can get their act together.
I don't have any sort of knowledge of who's going to win the final, you couldn't sort of rule out Hibs, could you?
Jonathan, your niche question.
Lamine Kone, since he arrived in January, has very, very quickly become a cult figure. And I think some haven't really had a cult figure since Julio Arca. And Kone has filled that gap incredibly quickly because he's massive. Good in the air, can pass the ball. And you know, all of the sophistication in modern football, for the tactics and the conditioning and the nutrition and everything else, there's still something great about watching a man kick a ball really, really, really hard. And those two goals he scored against Everton, one a volley from 6 yards, he hit really hard. And then one, just he could have, you know, he was 3 yards out with an open goal, but he made sure he kicked it really hard. So, I he's not the greatest player to play in the Premier League ever. But he can kick it really hard, and I like that.
Right, let's take another audience question quickly. This hand there was, I don't know, it's just a nice hand. Can't really see that far, to be honest. You've got lovely hands.
Thank you very much. In Scotland, in the past few years, obviously we've seen the demise and now the resurrection of Rangers. And in the time since Rangers have fallen away and then came back, somebody's actually assaulting me behind me here, is it? Since they've gone away and came back, we've not seen anybody win the league or come close to winning the league apart from Celtic, which is obviously quite disappointing. As a supporter of a smaller team, I was quite excited to see Rangers go away because it meant that we might see just a change to make Scottish football not very boring anymore. Obviously, it's been quite disappointing that we haven't seen that. Can the panel comment on is the death knell of Scottish football really now the fact that between Rangers' demise and then winning it again in a few years' time, nobody's going to win it except from Celtic? And is it as depressing as I think it is?
When I got my notes to chair this, I got end on a cheery note as one of them. Kevin, death knells, death, everything's terrible.
That's intrinsically a Scottish perspective, isn't it? Everything all doom. Because that's what normally happens for Scotland. But in this case, I think it's a very interesting Scottish Cup final. I mean, Rangers have come back through the four divisions as is required by the SFA.
Yes, but they're after not the Rangers.
Sorry. that was cheap. Cheap shot.
I mean, people go on about this, but the fact is, Rangers are back in. They're playing the game. It's been sanctioned by everyone. And people like a laugh and get some fun out of the humiliation of Rangers, which was their own fault, of course, you know, by spending crazy money under the chairman at that time. And the worst thing about it was when Rangers were spending enormous money, like 12 million for Torre Andrew Flo and so on. But the saddest thing about it was they spent all that money and didn't produce a team of any great standard in European football. I hope that's a lesson learned. Not many people could have found the money that Rangers did at that time, but I'd much rather see teams playing, buying players sensibly and having the knowledge to realise this guy might not look very good, but in 6 months or a year, he could really change our fortunes. And to me, that's better than money. And I think fans love that more, to see somebody they can identify with, not some stranger who's loaded with dosh.
Yeah. So I think it's possibly slightly unrealistic to expect, because of Rangers' demise in the last 4 years, to expect another team to come win the league. You know, Celtic have still got a huge budget. Celtic, I think, were always could only throw the league away in the last in the time since Rangers have been out of the league. I mean, Aberdeen came fairly close, but just in the final analysis, they didn't have the players, did they? And I think last season we finished 18 points behind Celtic. So I mean, there's still a big gap. But what I've enjoyed in the last three or four years is the domestic cups and clubs really having a chance to lift the domestic trophies. And we've had St Mirren, Ross County, Inverness, you know, and I really think, you know, I've enjoyed that. And it's been really quite refreshing for me. And it's kind of really reignited my passion a bit to see these smaller clubs have their day in the sun. And, you know, who knows, as I say this weekend, whether Hibs can have it this weekend. But for me, it's been great just to go to these towns like Dingwall and Perth to see the St Johnson bringing the cup back there. That was an amazing afternoon to be there and to witness that. So yeah, I've really enjoyed it, and I think it has been a bit more democratic last three or four years in Scottish football. And obviously Rangers being back might change things a bit now next year, but yeah, I don't know, it's not quite been the sort of Armageddon that some people were talking about.
What troubles me is the fact that the Alex Ferguson type in his great days in Aberdeen, someday we have to do that again now to revive and make Scottish football vibrant again, and that's a heck of a challenge. In those days, of course, you know, the money being spent on players was nothing at all, really. But now, if a really good player came to Aberdeen, first thing would be plan how many months before we sell him, or maybe next summer or whatever. That would be the thinking. Not, I think, getting back to the Cup Winners' Cup that Aberdeen once did. But I think that's the main question now. Try and milk money out of Europe. And I can understand that, but it seems these teams do not believe they can qualify or compete at the top level.
Okay, to chime that happy end note, I'm going to invoke violence. This is the city of Graham Souness. Who's the greatest hard one, the greatest and toughest player you've ever seen?
Well, I think hardness takes many forms, and it doesn't necessarily mean going around ending Sean Elliott's career. but we're talking about Lamine Kone, his son's sort of a cult figure who all fans love now. But when I was sort of going regularly in my teens, the great cult figure was John Kay, who was a right back we signed from Wimbledon. Never scored a goal for Sunderland. I think probably in retrospect wasn't actually a very good footballer. And he was not a tall man, but I guess he was only about 5'6", 5'7". Quite a thin man, but monstrously hard. Committed some horrendous tackles, horrendous fouls. But it's not just about dishing out. It's he broke his leg in a game and was stretchered off. And on the stretcher, he sat up and pretended to be kayaking. but the real mark of the man was a pre-season tour Sunderland did in the mid to late 90s down in the southwest, somewhere around Bristol. And they went to a pub after a game, and some local hard lad decides he'll have a pop at John Kay. He'll have a pop at the hard man of I guess would have been a second division team then, the championship team. And this bloke's massive, so Kay's never going to be able to actually have him in a fight. So Kay says to him, right, if you really think you're hard, follow me to the toilets. So the bloke's, okay, follows him to the toilet. And Kay goes in, and he reaches into the urinal and takes out, you know, those blue antiseptic cubes. Because if you're really hard, you'll do this, and puts them in his mouth and eats them. So, yeah, John Kay, the...
Alan. I told you it always comes back to Duncan Ferguson, and he I can safely say that Duncan Ferguson's the hardest player I've seen. But no, one of the great stories of Duncan Ferguson, I remember, is the time these two burglars, probably the most foolish burglars ever known in the history of burglary, it was the two guys that chose Duncan Ferguson's house to burgle one night, and unfortunately Duncan was at home, and he came down and caught them at it, and one of them was had his arms full of, I think, bottled champagne, man of the match champagne, and various other quarry from Duncan's kind of man shed or whatever it was, And this guy looks up and sees Duncan sort of towering over him and says, "Oh, sorry, Duncan. And put these goods down in front of him, saying, you can have it back, you can have them all back." And Duncan just looked at him and said, it doesn't work like that.
Kevin. The hardest man, perhaps a man from the Midlothian coalfields, I imagine.
Well, I mean, to speak of the toughest players, Dave Mackay, terrible injuries, and kept on coming back. And obviously, it later on becomes a centre-back kind of figure because his body is not going to be allowed to run up and down the pitch. But to in his mind, to change the way he's got to play the game, I thought his courage is both psychological and physical, and I think he should always be remembered.
Do you know what the obviously he was an enormous figure at Derby when they won the league, but do you know what Derby gave him as a retirement present? So after his final game, there's a presentation on the pitch, in which he's given this great gift to say thank you for these three or four years he spent there, but you know, transformed them as a club. They gave him a toaster.
It's practical.
I don't know if he kind of hadn't had a toaster and was sort of. Yeah, I'm going to have to go down to the shops and buy a toaster. And they always give him one. But
is there some kind of joke we're missing there? Was there some kind of innuendo in this? I don't know. I mean, or your toast. That's it.
Oof. A rare item in Derbyshire in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Philippe, finally.
Well, my first reaction was to say Kevin Muscat because he was a psycho. But we'll have to finish on a very Blizzardian reference to the man who has the most red cards to his credit in the history of football. And he's from Colombia.
The Uruguayans must be furious.
Absolutely. He's from Colombia. He's called Gerardo Bedoya. And he's got 46 in his career. And he recently became a manager. And... yes.
So think about that. 46 red cards. So let's assume that evenly split between two yellows and violent colours.
No, it was a violent chap. So most of them were actually straight reds. Straight reds. None of this Ponzi thing like one yellow, two yellows. Ah! No, not Vardy. No, proper red card.
And presumably he was getting multiple red cards a season. So he'd be getting the second one would be a 4-game ban, the third would be a 5-game. So you're saying he's probably missed on average, let's say a 3-game ban for each one.
Yeah.
46, he said. So that's
46, yeah.
138 games. That's 4 seasons.
Yeah, that's more than Jack Wilshere has been playing. And so he became manager. It's this year, actually. And his first game, he was sent off after 23 minutes. So I think he's a hard chap.
Which brings us beautifully to the end. So if you could give your thanks to Jonathan, Alan, Kevin, and Philippe.